to the Alaska World Affairs Council Presents on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Kristen Spack. The Alaska World Affairs Council brings the world to Alaska. World leaders, journalists, authors, educators, and entrepreneurs join Alaskans in a conversation about world affairs. This week, Joe Monfil, director of Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion, speaks on preventative diplomacy, advancing the Abrahamic Family Reunion. Joe Monfil is director of Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion, the Esalen Institute project to promote Muslim, Christian, Jewish reconciliation. He is also senior advisor on interfaith relations at Washington National Cathedral and has appointments at American and George Mason Universities. In 1994, Mr. Monfil founded the Preventative Diplomacy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which he directed until 2003. Before that, he spent 23 years as a diplomat with posts in the Middle East and North Africa. He also worked in the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs, Intelligence and Research, where he was chief of the Near East Division and director of the Office of Global Issues. Educated at Lehigh, Harvard, and Columbia Universities, Mr. Monfil is the editor of Conflict and Peacemaking in Multi-Ethnic Societies and editor of The Psychodynamics of International Relationships. On Friday, May 22nd, he spoke at the Alaska World Affairs Council on Preventative Diplomacy, Advancing the Abrahamic Family Reunion. In partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council, KSKA presents Director of Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion, Joe Monfil.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm overwhelmed by how well organized the Alaska World Affairs Council Anchorage is. I was booked so many months ago that I forget what year it was. And had my air ticket about a week after that, so I've never been so organized. I'm really impressed by also the level of continuous support. I was telling Rob, your president, that it's like booking Meet the Press every week. You've got to get people, and sometimes from long distances, to show up for the Friday lunch. I'm going to try to make some key sort of bullet points. And leave as much time for questions and answers and discussion as possible, because you have a lot of things to do, and a lot of people have day jobs. The introductory bio tells you a little bit. Certainly you hear something about my formal foreign service career. I served in Iraq, Lebanon, Libya, and Morocco. I had a year in Egypt as a Fulbrighter. And then the bulk of my career was spent in the Bureau of Near Eastern and South Asian Affairs in the Department of State. I'm a Middle East specialist. I studied intensive Arabic in the Foreign Service Institute schools and dealt with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in general, U.S. policy in the Middle East, and Israel and the Middle East. That's the formal side of on the diplomatic side. The Track 2 diplomacy concept that was mentioned came to me while I was very much on active duty in the State Department, and actually went out to Esalen Institute in Big Sur, California, which is not a conventional place for Foreign Service officers to go for conferencing. But it's a very creative environment right there on the Pacific, an incredibly beautiful place. At the invitation of the co-founder of Esalen, Michael Murphy, and his wife, Dulcie Murphy. And that was to work on the U.S.-Soviet relationship, the psychology of the U.S.-Soviet relationship. It was at a time when, after the Soviets invaded Afghanistan during the Carter administration, didn't know what to do about it. We were very upset. We weren't going to go to war with the Soviet Union, but we cut off all kinds of cultural and communications relationships. We also made a policy to kill the Summer Olympics that were scheduled for Moscow. We stopped talking, and a number of citizens around the country thought it's crazy to stop talking to a country that has so many hydrogen bombs on intercontinental ballistic missiles aimed at you. There must be a smarter way to deal with such a dangerous situation. Of course, we had even more aimed at them. It was a very unhealthy, crazy situation. And so Esalen people, the Murphys, had taken some initiatives to establish human communication, what I came to be called an aspect of Track 2 diplomacy, unofficial informal engagement with representatives of adversaries to try to counteract the very predictable psychological processes among enemy tribes and enemy nations, which is to establish distance and to dehumanize the other, to consider whatever the nation is, basically evil, and dehumanization, what political psychologists have come to realize, is a process that prepares one tribe or nation. And I keep going back and forth because many of our nations aren't really much different from tribes in some of the ways we manage our relationships with other tribes or nations, and we frequently break down into war. And of course, Europe has been the theater of an incredible slaughter. So it's not the modernized West that's been the leader in the civilization, except after we've slaughtered ourselves enough to build some serious institutions after World War II to try to stop that. It was clear that there was a leadership role for unofficial diplomacy for leaders of various sectors of society, academics, journalists, artists, poets, business people, engineers. When the Esalen U.S.-Soviet exchange program started, I think Steve Jobs got involved. There was a San Bernardino, Moscow jazz festival and a space bridge in the earlier days of space satellites when you could actually communicate live around the world. An astronaut-cosmonaut program that symbolized the humanity of the astronauts and the cosmonauts and the virtue of the two countries working together on a shared, what you might call a superordinate goal in space exploration. So the track two, the citizen diplomacy part, got started. And also preventive diplomacy, which was a term we used at the Center for Strategic International Studies, was really a concept that grew out of the citizen diplomacy movement. But it meant what it meant. It's very simple. It means if you see a problem, you study it in depth, psychological depth, historical depth, and try to design policies and ways of acting, both official and unofficial, that try to solve the problem or make it less of a problem, less threatening. It means being adult and intervening when you see a problem coming down the pike, not waiting as you would if you were a fireman for the bell to ring. Much of our diplomacy and foreign policy has been in that category. So that's what preventive diplomacy is, not rocket science. Now, how does this apply to Muslim, Christian, Jewish reconciliation? Well, as I told you right at the beginning, my area of specialty, my mother conflict, is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or the Arab-Israeli conflict. And when I was in the Near East Bureau for all those years, there was always a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State who was in charge of the peace process, in charge of the negotiations. And I was impressed by the number of those Deputy Assistant Secretaries of State who took early retirement. Well, it was very hard to move things. Henry Kissinger managed to get a very significant partial withdrawal agreements with Egypt and Syria, and Jimmy Carter facilitated a major breakthrough, although the initiative came from Anwar Sadat in Egypt, who decided that there was so much paralysis at the official track one diplomatic level that he had to take an initiative, and he decided to go to Israel himself without consulting with us. It really hurts our feelings when people do that. But in fact, it was a suggestion that Walter Cronkite made on his evening television program. And he used that, Sadat used that as a catalyst to justify one of the most fantastic initiatives, really, in the 20th century. It stunned the Israelis because it was cognitive dissonance for them. They came from an experience of being Jewish in Europe for centuries that meant being despised and episodically murdered. And they came to a place in the Middle East that they didn't quite know how to adjust to, that is in their relationships with their neighbors, and felt that they were surrounded by enemies in a permanent state of enmity, and all they could do to protect themselves was fight and be militarily superior. And you know that method of survival is evident now in the Israeli tremendous anxiety about the Iranian threat. Well, when Sadat decided to go to Israel and stood in the Knesset, the symbol of the new Jewish state and its legitimacy and its rootedness in the region, the Knesset, the parliament of the Jewish state, and he said, "We accept you in our midst." He was telling the Jewish founders of New Israel, of the modern state of Israel, something that they had never heard in Europe. After the Declaration of the Rights of Man in France, Jews were acknowledged as possessors of individual human rights, but not as group rights or group identity. Now, there's no time, and it wouldn't really repay the effort to try to walk through all the episodes of aggression and response, loss, trauma. But all I will say is that the history is the accumulation of losses and the memories that never let those losses go. Human beings in their identity groups, again, tribes and nations, and we can name it whether currently in Sri Lanka we've had a defeat of a Tamil insurrection leader, a terrorist leader in Ceylon, in Sri Lanka, by the Sinhalese government. But we've had we have constant tension in the Turkish-Armenian relationship. In Northern Ireland, it went for several decades with constant murder of civilians and also some soldiers and some policemen. These ethnic and sectarian conflicts, what that seemed to be intractable, and of course the Israeli and the Palestinian one, so are sustained by memories that people acquire over the decades and centuries of a sense of loss and injustice. They've been attacked. And they acquired what we call a victimhood psychology, and it's not meant to be a pejorative term. It's something that they come by honestly. They've suffered aggression, acts of aggression, and traumatic losses. Secondly, by any standard, the attack and the aggression was unjustified. And the third and most interesting aspect of the psychology of victimhood is that there's a constant fear that the aggressor is just waiting for another chance to hurt them again. So people in a victimhood psychology have elevated stressor hormones in their brains. They're on the alert for aggression. They're very distrustful of anything, any gestures, peace gestures the other side might make, or any subtle indirect gestures. Their brains are mobilized for defense and fast reaction to an act of aggression, not for gentle, Isaiah-like problem solving. And therefore, there's a need for third parties to help to intervene in these relationships and try to facilitate communication between groups that are in conflict, Israelis, Palestinians, Egyptians. I've done a lot of that, as well as with Russians and Eastern Europeans, but I'll focus on the Middle East. So that each side can educate the other on the human dimensions of their fear and their memories and their hurts. In most human cases, human beings don't dwell a lot on whether or not our tribe or nation has inflicted painful wounds on another people. People don't do, especially if we've won. Human beings are such that there's very little incentive to do critical, retrospective self-analysis. Where did we go wrong? How did we hurt these people? If you're the winner, there's not that much pressure. But in fact, the wounds of history are what sustain the continuing violence and threat and the loss of innocent life. And constantly defy formal Track 1 diplomacy. Track 1 diplomacy doesn't know how to handle healing history. And that's what my project is about. And focusing on the Middle East it became clearer and clearer. I focused a lot on the psychology, as I've been describing, the self-psychology, the wounded self, the hunger for recognition, acceptance, and respect that we all have as individuals and members of nations. How this gets integrated into formal diplomacy and peacemaking is challenging. There are definitions of public diplomacy that are emerging and giving more and more scope for the support of this kind of engagement. The United States Institute of Peace, USIP.org, in Washington has been for more than 20 years now promoting research and engagement on really the art and science of peacemaking. And it's through its fellowship programs and scholarships and grant programs has contributed significantly to that. And on the 2nd of June, I'm going to be on a panel with Michael Henderson, a British author and journalist, who will be discussing a book Baylor University just published of his called No Enemy to Conquer. And it's on the function of forgiveness in peacemaking. Now, with all due respect for the office of the Vice President of the United States, I can't imagine a discussion with Dick Cheney about forgiveness in dealing with what seems to be an intractable, insoluble ethnic and sectarian conflict. That the Peace Institute is doing this. And it has, and I'm going to be, as I said, on the panel, I contributed one of the chapters, the analytical chapters, in a bunch of stories that Michael Henderson wrote about how it worked with individuals and representatives of groups who, when there was an expression of an acknowledgement by the aggressor, the perpetrator, of a hurt, of an act of aggression, even if it went back 500 years, 1,000 years, it was listened to very carefully, and especially if it was accompanied by a sense of contrition. Oh, I'm sorry. We're sorry. That actually can have a measurable effect on the level of stressor hormones in the brains of people who've been on the alert for a new attack by their antagonists. And it may very well result in forgiveness. I'm quite militant on the acknowledgement and contrition side of the transaction, because forgiveness will come. I know it will come, but the victims may not very well hold a press conference and say we forgive. It may come in the shape of a transformation in the way they're willing to relate with their enemies or their former enemies. And sort of tacitly accepting or getting used to the idea that a new relationship has become possible because the adversary, the aggressor, said, we're sorry. We did you wrong, and we're sorry, and we want to make it better. So how does that affect the Muslim-Christian-Jewish relationship? Well, that's the political psychology side I've just been describing. The religion side is that religion is such a critical part of the collective identity of the actors in the Middle East conflict. And look at the fights throughout the centuries over who owns God, whose sacred literature is the most sacred, is the most true. Christians have accepted the Hebrew Bible, the Pentateuch, the records, the stories of the prophets recorded in the Hebrew Bible. But for the very longest time, in fact, until the mid-1960s, the Church and Christendom in general, the Catholic Church and Christendom in general, didn't really accept the covenant between God and the Jewish people as legitimate. And that's the least part of the problem. For the longest time, from the second, third century of the Common Era, Jews were assigned this burden that became a dogma in the church of perpetual collective guilt for the murder of Jesus Christ. That's not a good way to have to go through history. Especially in Christian majority countries, and it was agony to be Jewish in Christian Europe, and so that memory was accumulated and put ultimately tremendous energy when nationalism was breaking out in the 19th century, and after the experience of some of the most brilliant Jewish leaders, intellectuals, journalists, scientists, academics, who came to the conclusion that the Christians will simply not accept Jews as equal and worthy people. And this is a result of this heritage of Jews being always singled out for disapproval, having been the murderers of Jesus Christ. It was only in 1965 that the Catholic Church in the Second Vatican Council, through the document Nostra Aetate, actually absolved the Jews from the murder of Jesus Christ. And that's several years after the Holocaust became public knowledge. It's been hell to be a Jew under Christian rule. Now, I emphasize in Europe because there's a very different story about being Jewish under Muslim rule. And it was not always a bed of roses. Muslims, first of all, the prophet of Islam really saw the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, as part of a broad community. And in fact, and wanted to bring the wisdom and the ethical values to a very anarchic tribal environment in Arabia, where he was born and raised in Mecca and Hejaz. He wanted to bring normative guidelines. And in his town in Mecca, it was a polytheistic society. And he wanted to bring the belief in the one God so that there was one authority, a source of authority for ethical behavior. There were spiritual benefits, but there were political and social benefits. Rights, far more rights for women than they ever had. The ending of infanticide and sacrifices to gods, brawling and the way tribes do. And I might say the European countries before, up to and after the Second World War acted in the same way. So the Muslim concept is that there's one great book in heaven, and that they're in three volumes. The first volume was sent to the Jewish people in the form of the Torah. The second volume was sent to the Christians in the form of the Gospels. And the third and final chapter was sent to the Muslims. Muslims believe the Jews did not follow God's directions, and the Christians did not follow God's directions. And God made a final attempt to help people get it right. But there's an inclusive concept of the Abrahamic family there that most of us are totally oblivious to, Christians and Jews, although Jewish scholars are much more deeply invested in knowledge and creating knowledge about Islam, its history, and Jewish-Muslim relations throughout the centuries. So my project is called Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion very deliberately. I'm a political psychologist. I believe in the power of symbolism. And one of the most moving episodes in the Bible, at least in the Hebrew Bible, is in the book of Genesis when Ishmael joins Isaac to bury their father Abraham in the cave of Machpelah just outside of Hebron. All of us have had loved ones who have died. All of us have had alienation, many of us, if we haven't experienced it personally in our families, know enough in our extended families that there's alienation. So the image of an alienated brother, and after all, Ishmael as a little boy was set out of the house by Abraham because Sarah didn't like having him around because she wanted to focus on Isaac. So Ishmael and his mother Hagar were sent out into the desert. And I won't go further into the story, but symbolically, these were people who were expelled. But clearly Abraham is the father of Ishmael at Sarah's suggestion before she finally became pregnant at age 99 or something like that. But the brothers return, alienated brothers, and the power of the symbolism is that Isaac represents the Jews and ultimately the Christians who descended from the Jews, and Ishmael in Arabic, represents the Arab and the Muslim people. So it's the Jews and the Muslims and their symbolic representatives in the book of Genesis come back together to bury their father, who is the prophet honored by all three faiths. So I have made a command decision that we are a family, and that we're going to effect a reunion. and have enough knowledge about human desire for connectedness and recognition, acceptance, and respect, and for healing, that the idea of a reunion as a family is plausible and possible. Now, there's a great burden of history that we have to deal with in terms of losses. And you can name them, the establishment of the State of Israel, the displacement of the Palestinians from many parts of the original Palestine, Muslim and Arab Palestinian terrorism against Israeli civilians. There's a lot of blood been shed, and a major part of our reconciliation process that I'm really focused on as a Christian, admittedly very flawed Christian, raised as a Catholic, is Christendom's debt to the Jewish people, because in order to win the trust of the Israelis, I think we need to have much more explicit acknowledgement of how they got into the dilemma they are and what Christendom's role. And here I go back to this issue: when you're on the winning side of a battle, as Christians have been, there's not much incentive to say, "Where did we go wrong?" Hell, we didn't go wrong. We won. There's a saying in Washington I've always liked. It says, never explain, never apologize. And that has been obvious in much of our political activity and a lot of our diplomacy. So that's what preventive diplomacy and the Abrahamic family reunion is all about. I want to, if you forget everything or remember only one thing from my talk, it's not to look at the website that's on the card that you got about CSIS. It's a great website, but I'm not on it anymore. I would ask you to go to Abrahamic Family Reunion. It's all one word, abrahamicfamilyreunion.org. And it has, it's a rather rich site. It has about 40 years accumulation of my work in this field and a lot of other people. And it lays out the theory and practice for academic study or for seminaries, theologians, but also for ordinary citizen practitioners, people who just want to do their part for the family reunion. There's a proliferation of Jewish and Christian, Jewish and Muslim Americans, and in some cases, Abrahamic interfaith groups just growing up all over the country. My project works in the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Washington, New York, and Boston. My way of thinking, I'm humbled to realize, but proud to say, has been contaminating the thinking of the Boston Theological Institute in Boston, which is a consortium of a very distinguished religious studies department, seminaries and schools of theology, Harvard Divinity School, Boston University, Boston College, Andover Newton, Gordon Conwell, Evangelical School, the Greek Orthodox Seminary, and they're having a conference next month that is inspired by toward the Abrahamic family reunion process. It's how the teaching of religion should be done in an age of interreligious consciousness, how theology and theological curricula have to be modernized to include the walk through history, the concept of healing history, and building on shared values like we're all God's children, made in the image of God. You can cite that in sacred literature of all three traditions. Don't get involved in more complex theological discussions. Basically, the guidelines is to follow for religious Jews, Muslims, and Christians to accept the two great commandments: love God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and body, and to love thy neighbor as thyself. It's not a fantasy. It's a very realistic way of defining foreign policy and diplomacy. Thank you.
You've been listening to Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Joe Monfil, recorded in Anchorage on May 22nd. The director of Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion, Mr. Monfil, spoke on preventative diplomacy, advancing the Abrahamic family reunion, and then he responded to questions from the audience. While Jews, Christians, and Buddhists have made enormous strides in the past, we're still left with the legacy of the radical Islamists, the first audience member stated. He asked Mr. Monfil, can you give us some insight in terms of a pathway that might lead some of these more radical Islamic sects in the same direction?
Yes, that's a very good question, and it's a very topical question. Muslims who reject radicalism and violence have been mobilizing in civil society institutions and religious institutions to marginalize, to recognize, and to delegitimize claims of people who use terrorism in the murder of civilians, and to say that's Islamic. They have to be delegitimized, and they are being by muftis and religious leaders. I have a colleague, Douglas Johnson, who formed the International Center for Religion and Diplomacy in Washington. He recruited me for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He has had an incredibly successful program in Pakistan, working with Pakistani citizens of Pakistan, in gradually introducing curriculum changes in the madrasas in Pakistan. Including Wahhabi and Deobandi, theoretically the most radical of the religious schools in Islam. And I've met some of the leaders of these people because they come to Washington. I can't believe that they're very, very embracing of all God's children and very, very liberal, and they love the curriculum. It starts with math and science and empowering disciplines that get the kids beyond memorizing the Quran into getting some marketable skills. And it's being accepted in the Pakistani Ministry of Education as a model, and there are innovations in establishing women's girls' schools with the same kind of modernizing curriculum. So again, it's a question of an intervention, of caring enough about the people who are desperate so that they provide a nourishing environment for radicalism, and identifying one of the serious problems in poverty and the maldistribution of income in Pakistan, and that leaves open to the financiers of militant ideologies to establish the schools where the families wouldn't have any place else to send. That's one example. I'm on the president's advisory board for Common Cause. Bob Edgar is the president of Common Cause. And we are trying to arrange a visit to Iran with some former members of Congress, a small delegation, to engage with people. There have been a number of I wouldn't say track two, because that's a suspicious word for certain elements of the Iranian security apparatus, but there have been religious delegations and scientific delegations and artists. And the idea is to establish the experience, much like the earliest Esalen program with the Soviet Union, to establish human contact. And the proposal we've made to the Iranians is to bring a small film crew so that the real-life human beings who are Iranians, and it's a very complex and creative society, and people who visit there just come back just amazed by how incredibly civilized it is. Now, it had a rough revolution, and there is an anxiety on the part of the current ruling the ruling mullahs about their survival, and it's a complex transformation that I know that good creative public diplomacy, citizen diplomacy, can help the Iranians who want to change do so. And it's going to be fascinating to watch how Barack Obama actually designs an engagement strategy with them. But that's the answer. Work with Muslims in your own state. They're very anxious to have Christian and Jewish allies. And you mentioned earlier, the Hindus and Buddhists, all my approach is they're all God's children and all precious. Every single one is precious. I focus on the Muslims and Christians and Jews because there's been a lot of death in my career, my colleagues. There was a lot of nuclear weapons involved in the Abrahamic relationship. And it's the most dangerous of the relationships. But the philosophy and even theology, if I might be so bold, is to embrace all God's children.
As a former member of the State Department, can you give an assessment on how the State Department is doing these days?
You're absolutely right about victimhood and the State Department and the Foreign Service. I'm so tired of reading about low morale in the State Department. I've been reading about it for 40 years. There's a lot of interesting symbolism. I think I've run into a number of people who just don't like the Foreign Service because they failed the Foreign Service exam. Well, I failed a couple of times myself, but that was all I wanted to do, and I kept coming back till they had to accept me. So that's this meritocracy aspect. But there's also in the old days, the Foreign Service was basically Harvard and Yale and the Ivy Leagues. It was sort of considered a privileged position. And after World War II, it became actually very, very diversified. And now it is a very accurate picture, I think, of American diversity. But the memory of that. But the training of the Foreign Service has not been adequate to the tasks that our diplomacy, the new concept of, say, the 3D, defense, diplomacy, and development. If the State Department wants to claim the role of being the leader in fulfilling smart diplomacy, it has to acquire the skills. The reason the Defense Department has been involved in so many things, beyond Rumsfeld having utter contempt for the State Department, he's not alone. He's just one of the most unashamed of his disdain. But the fact is, the Defense Department has big budgets, operational budget. It has trucks, and they get and it has an ethos of they'll always salute and do whatever the Commander in Chief says. And the State Department doesn't have that kind of operational. So the House Foreign Affairs Committee just passed an authorization to add, I believe, 1,500 new positions. Civilian positions in state and AID to give the person power to the State Department to actually do operational stuff, to go to villages and help people not only dig wells, but to connect to road networks and to help show, first of all, show respect for the least among us. And go to Afghanistan. That's part of the ethos, by the way, the very fundamental ethos in the Abrahamic family, shared values. The real, a godly society, a decent society, cares about the least among us. And that's, we have to share that, project that attitude towards the poorest of the poor in countries that we're involved in because of security reasons and countries we're not involved in. Caring, to me, is one of the most important values in the Judeo-Christian Muslim ethos. And it's deeply rooted in the ethos. And I think that to the extent that that becomes enveloped in our foreign policy, the way we behave, and I think I am absolutely passionate about Barack Obama. I think he's trying to integrate that concept of caring for the least among us without pretensions, without bullying, without pretensions of power, but using it when it's necessary.
The next audience member asked two questions. First, he asked, the Central Asia Institute, led by Greg Mortensen, is building schools in Afghanistan and Pakistan. How is that going? Secondly, he asked, isn't the Israeli-Palestinian conflict more about who controls what land as opposed to religion?
Greg Mortensen, I don't know. Is that the Three Cups of Tea?
Yes.
Okay. I bought the book, and like many in my library, I haven't read it yet. But it's been recommended by so many people, and it sounds like it's exactly the kind of leadership initiative from an unofficial person who cares about people that's had a great impact. The Three Cups of Tea story is the model that I'm talking about. And it cannot help but succeed because human beings respond to respect and caring from other human beings. Ideally, the more Americans are those other human beings, the better off we're going to be in our diplomacy. Now, Israel and Palestine. It's certainly a fight over land. The draft peace plans are about land. The Palestinian leadership has accepted the losing all but 22% of traditional Palestine, mandatory Palestine. And so the fight now is over how much of the West Bank can be recovered in a peace agreement in Gaza. There are political complications in the Palestinian leadership between Fatah and Hamas. There are major political complications for Israeli governments. I've been just reading Haaretz today online. The sharpest Israeli commentators are saying that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has to choose between having a good, meaningful relationship with a very serious new American president who is focused and determined to move the situation, and keeping his coalition together, his right-wing coalition together. So the domestic politics on both sides are very complex. Sometimes we say, we have seen the light at the end of the tunnel. We just don't know how to reach the tunnel. That's the diplomatic process. That's the peace process. And there are plenty of Israelis who support the compromises, the sort of the Geneva Accord, which was a product of unofficial Track 2 initiative, the Taba Agreement. There are all kinds of plans that that make it clear what the light at the end of the tunnel is going to look like. But there are intense passions. There's concern in Israel that many of the settlers are so, and they're all armed, that maybe I've seen estimates, heard estimates from Israelis citing Shin Bet sources, the domestic security group, that there are anywhere from 3,000 to 7,000 settlers who are ready to kill Israeli soldiers and policemen who come to dismantle settlements. It makes one hesitate to dismantle settlements unless there's a greater environment and public opinion to support it. Other people who are nonviolent settlers have said that Israel is a democracy, and if the government of Israel decides to evacuate settlements, it'll do what the government says, what the Knesset says. But more than those are the sort of the hard-nosed issues in negotiation, the track one issues. But what I've been trying to do in my project is to recover the memory of Jewish-Muslim engagement, especially in the medieval Mediterranean, Muslim Spain, Al-Andalus especially, that was quite remarkable. Muslims and Jews together, I mean, technically, the Jews were a subordinate, a protected minority, as the Christians were under Muslim rules. And they had certain rights to practice their religion and so on. But they weren't supposed to ride horses. They're supposed to ride donkeys and little things like that, so they wouldn't forget that they had a lower status. But what happened in Al-Andalus in the medieval ages, and even in the Ottoman Empire, and all across the Mediterranean area into Persia, the rulers were not militant enforcers of second-class citizenship. They all had sought Jewish physicians to be their physicians, the sultans. I'm preparing to send a book to a publisher, the seven wonderful authors. It's called History as Prelude, Muslims and Jews in the Middle East. And there's a long passage from Maimonides when he was in Cairo and the court physician for this, the Sultan, and he was describing his work day. He had gotten a letter from somebody, I think in Greece, that wanted to come and study with him, and Maimonides is saying, don't expect to have any time. And he described his work day. He got up very early, went from Fustat in south of Cairo to Cairo, where the Sultan's palace was. He had to see all of the Sultan's families, and Muslim families, especially if they're ruling families, can be very large, wives, concubines, many, many children. And he'd have to stay sometimes until late in the afternoon and make his way back home. And when he got back home, his anteroom would be filled with people of all religions, for a physician it didn't matter, waiting to be diagnosed and treated. And he said, by the end of the day, well after dinner time, he would be receiving people lying on a couch because he was too tired to sit up and talk to his patients. And so it was it's a very sweet story because it comes from, what, the 11th century. And it's so so human, and so you can really sympathize with the guy. And so he said, "You can come to my house, but you're not going to have any time." And this is one of the most the greatest Jewish philosophers and scientists and leaders in Judaism, in historic Judaism. In fact, he's so great that Muslims also claim him. I've been in a debate between Palestinians and Israelis and Jews over who owns Maimonides more. There's a lot of history to recover, a lot of memory to recover that's positive. Historians really are convinced now that the Jews and the Muslims, with a lesser supporting role of the Christians in Spain, Al-Andalus, actually preserved not only preserved ancient learning that had come from Persia and Iraq, the Abbasid Caliphate, but it made enormous value added in terms of science, engineering, philosophy, Sufism, medicine, and really laid the basis, and passing it through Toledo and the translation schools in Toledo, that became the basis of the Renaissance in Italy. A nationalist and Christian, passionate Christian historians have often neglected that part about the origins of the Renaissance, but that's the truth. So just in recovering this kind of history, you're reconstructing a sense of good self and worth and the Jews and Muslims as allies, as co-creators of a civilization and advancers. And it's a rather sad contrast with the Jewish experience in Christian Europe. I believe passionately, as a track one diplomat, I did supervise intelligence analysis in the State Department. I'm not a romantic. That this recovering of memory and history and reconstruction of a sense of good and worthy self is tremendously important to supplement the land exchange deals that part of track one diplomacy. And hopefully this will become part of a public diplomacy with much more vigorous government support. Right now, those of us who do it are living from month to month and trying to get private foundations and donors to support us, this kind of work. But I think we're coming to a point now where there's going to be more recognition of the value of this. And maybe this worldwide transmission of this program will be helpful.
As a Scotch, Irish, Southern Baptist, Polish Jew raised as a Unitarian agnostic, the next audience member wanted to know, how do you deal with the separation of church and state?
Yeah. Well, on a personal basis, have you considered becoming a Buddhist? And, you envelop so many of these historical conflicts. One sage said, history is just one damn thing after another. And you sort of, all your relatives have experienced that. But actually, I believe in the cognitive and the analytical side of this psychological work, too. Church and state. Well, I've concluded after reading as much as I could into the sacred literature and the goals of the prophets, the more creative of the Jewish prophets, Jesus and Muhammad, that as soon as the prophets die, the politics takes over. There is the alpha males push forward and then fight for who's going to be the king, who's going to be the tribal leader. There may be some creative assassination involved in establishing political rule. Constantine the Great, who gave Christendom an army when he decided to accept Christianity as a legitimate religion for the Roman Empire, and he ultimately even had a deathbed conversion to Christianity himself, also in the process of political administration, murdered his wife and two sons. It was a very mixed legacy of Christian values. So anybody wants to talk about church and state, let's talk about how politics and human political activity corrupts what the prophets meant. And there's no set of values that can't be accommodated in as open and honest a form of government, of statehood, of statecraft. And so we have to work on the idea of democracy and human rights and human values. And believe me, all the religious values are easily accommodated.
On the track to diplomacy are organizations such as Hamas, which have been democratically elected, invited to be part of the conversation.
Well, I had a boss in the State Department a number of years ago when he would get a difficult question like that, would say, I'll jump off that bridge when I come to it. There are going to be elections in the West Bank and Gaza for president and the Palestinian parliament in January next year. And people are watching to see how that there's been a fairly steady drop in Hamas support publicly because of a very, very bloody rule in Gaza. But not in a gradual rise in Fatah and Abu Mazen's support. I think there's a policy, certainly on the U.S. side, and I think Obama's going to continue to pressure the Israelis to do what they can to improve the situation in the West Bank so that that the general feeling is such that when people go to the polls, they'll vote for the leadership that is most promising. One of the things that Hamas, I just read again in, this morning, is refusing to do is to accept the agreements that the PLO and the Palestinian Authority has made with the Israelis up to now, which is recognition of the state and so on. And they're holding out on that. And they may not be willing to concede that because of a strong ideology. Although there are many Hamas policy people who are proposing that the promised 10-year truce could easily be extended and give enough time for them to come around to a form of wording of accepting. And I would actually encourage accepting in dealing with Israel as a Jewish state, a religious Jewish state, that is, where, on terms of religious, shared religious values. I just read a report by a professor at Bar-Ilan University in Israel, which is the Orthodox university, and he is repeating what I've learned over the years that Muslims are Israelis. Are much more responsive to religious Jews than to secular Jews because they feel that there is a shared history and a shared set of it. So there's something to work with there. But again, track one, formal diplomacy, has a little bit of have a lot of trouble in integrating my approach, which probably is best not to be part of the talking points of a president anyway, but should be supported as trying to create an environment where presidents and prime ministers can generate public opinion that supports creative healing approaches. So I see a parallel, an integrated process where the unofficial, the track two work, can be a real asset to formal diplomacy.
This concludes Alaska World Affairs Council Presents Joe Montville, Director of Toward the Abrahamic Family Reunion, the Esalen Institute project to promote Muslim-Christian-Jewish reconciliation. He responded to questions from the audience following his talk entitled Preventative Diplomacy, Advancing the Abrahamic Family Reunion, recorded in Anchorage on Friday, May 22, 2009. These broadcasts are produced by KSKA Public Radio in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. Visit kska.org to sign up for free podcasts of Alaska World Affairs Council Presents. You can also sign up for email updates about the show and share your comments with us and other listeners online at kska.org. This has been a presentation of KSKA in partnership with the Alaska World Affairs Council. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.